From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. In a moment, we're going to Mars. Robert Zubrin is going to command that ship. Later tonight, the power of dreams. Here's what's happening. The sad death of Margot Kidder, who famously played Lois Lane in the Superman movies in the 70s and 80s, apparently committed suicide. In a statement provided to the Associated Press, the coroner, Richard Wood, said she died as a result of self-inflicted drug and alcohol overdose. No further details released. She died on May 13th. They've just released that report. Sad story there. Well, you've heard across the country we've been talking about E. coli in romaine lettuce. Well, here's the latest. This spring's large E. coli outbreak, apparently caused by tainted romaine lettuce, may have been caused by a large industrial cattle farm. That according to a new FDA hypothesis. A concentrated animal feeding operation whose water came in contact with the affected romaine lettuce from the Yuma, Arizona growing region. The water may have been used for irrigation, and sample testing revealed in June that it was tainted with E. coli. Our food safety coach, Jeff Nelken, with us. Geez, Jeff, we can't escape any of this, can we?
Well, it just goes to show us that, you know, when you have large amounts of animal waste, that it needs to be controlled, and if it's not controlled and it's not checked, it can soak into the ground and it can contaminate water, you know, ways. And that's one of the theories, that the E. coli got into, you know, the water, and that this water was used for, you know, purposes of, you know, used in the
spraying the romaine lettuce,
eating of the, you know, crops.
Yep.
So, you know, the government is going to have to more frequently come in and, you know, spot check. You know, coming in once or twice a year is not sufficient.
And I assume the romaine lettuce farm was pretty darn close, if not neighboring, to the cattle farm.
Well, you know what? It could have been that, as well as if there's piles of manure and there's wind blowing, you know.
Oh.
That's another possibility. You know, if it's that close.
Will washing the romaine lettuce get rid of the E. coli, Jeff?
It may get rid of some of the E. coli, but if the E. coli has an opportunity to penetrate into the cellular structure, washing the lettuce won't get the internal E. coli. It may get some of the E. coli on the surface, but once it's in the cellular structure, or if there's any bruise, you know, bruise in the vegetable, that's one of the reasons when you buy produce, for example, you shouldn't buy bruised produce, because that's the entry level, the way that, you know, E. coli can possibly get into the product.
Our producer, Tom Danheiser, Jeff, every time we go out to dinner, you know, that's all he eats is romaine lettuce. He loves his Caesar salads. He has, since we've had this story over the last several months, he has stopped eating romaine lettuce. Is that something people should do, just simply stop eating it?
Well, the point is that usually they isolate, you know, where the lettuce was coming from. And if it gets to the point where they don't know, then they would, you know, they would put the word out to stay off of it. But they haven't, and they've pretty much isolated it to certain areas, you know, where this product may have come from.
Jeff's website, foodsafetycoach.com. Thank you, Jeffrey. Veterinarians in Virginia are warning pet owners to be on the lookout for a mysterious disease similar to spreading among canines in the Charlottesville area there. The Autumn Trails Veterinary Center there said they've treated roughly 22 dogs already for this disease in the past week. Concerned, they have contacted other practices in the area to see if they're noticing an uptick. Speaking of ticks, ticks and insects in general are steadily spreading across the United States and causing more disease, aided by an ever warmer climate. If that's not bad enough, though, it's almost certain that an invasive species of tick, newly discovered last year, has firmly established itself in America as its home. And this tick is potentially capable of causing even more frightening illnesses. The Asian long-horned tick has now been spotted in 7 states, mostly along the East Coast, according to the New York Times. It was first discovered on a pet sheep in New Jersey last summer and had been seen this summer in Arkansas, North Carolina, New York, Virginia, and West Virginia. Just last week, Pennsylvania became the latest state to report this tick sighting. Let's check in, of course, with Dr. Gary Ridenour. Gary, how bad is a tick bite, or what's so bad about a tick?
Well, the thing is with a tick is that this species that we're talking about 50 of them can sit on the head of a dime. That's how small they are. So you don't really see them until they're gorged with blood. But they can carry things like most other ticks, other families can carry Rocky Mountain fever, Lyme disease, Colorado tick fever, something called tularemia. And in Eastern Asia, there's a tick that carries a virus that causes complete organ failure in humans.
Now, we're you know, this planet's 4.5 billion years old, and they're talking about a brand new species, a tick. Where in the heck did it come from?
Well, ticks came around about 100 million years ago, and, you know, there's a ton of insects out there that we've not identified. You know, this may not be a newcomer. In fact, this tick has been found in amber 75 million years ago.
Jeez.
So he's not a new boy. But like you said, they're invasive, and some of the females are asexual, which means they have male and female organs and can produce their own eggs without having a male around. So
self-replicating, indeed. Now,
yeah.
in this case with the tick, if you find a tick, whether it's this Asian longhorn or any other tick, if you find a tick on your body, how do you get it off?
First thing you do is you use some fine-tipped tweezers. You place it, the tweezers close to the skin, covering as much of the head as you can get, and then pull it straight out. Make sure that the head and the pincers are not left behind in the skin, and then wash the skin and maybe put some antibiotic cream on it. They said don't squash the tick because he's maybe filled with blood and bad viruses, so flush him down the toilet.
Dr. Ridenour's website, pandemicdirect.com. Gary, thank you, and it's good to have you back on the program. Looking for a more natural digestive system cleanse? You may be able to find the ingredients right in your own backyard. A new study finds that adding crickets to your daily diet may be good for your gut and offer several health benefits. No thank you. A British man said he felt let down after discovering he was mourning for his daughter at the wrong grave since July of 1988. He thought that's where she was buried and would go visit her twice a year. And he was surprised to find out finally that he was at the wrong grave. Well, we're going to Mars, and the fellow who's going to be taking us is Robert Zubrin, and he's next with us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Well, NASA says there's not enough carbon dioxide on Mars to terraform it, giving it an atmosphere. And space entrepreneur Elon Musk says, yes, there will be, no problem. And, of course, we know what Robert Zubrin will say in a second. Robert is the president of the Pioneer Astronautics and Mars Society, as well as a senior fellow with the Center for Security Policy. He has studied and researched the fields of aerospace and energy. He's got a Ph.D. in nuclear engineering as well. A couple of his books, How to Live on Mars and Merchants of Despair. Robert, welcome back, my friend. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for inviting me.
So NASA says there's not enough carbon dioxide on Mars to terraform it. What say you, Robert?
Okay, well, actually, that's not NASA. That's Professor Bruce Joukowsky at the University of Colorado. NASA just reprinted his paper. That's a very flawed paper. It's based on no data. Joukowsky is an investigator on a satellite that has measured the amount of CO2 that Mars has lost in its history, which is about half as much as would be needed to create an Earth atmosphere thickness. But that says nothing about how much is left. It's like if you say someone has lost $1,000, does that mean they're broke or they still have $1 million? You don't know. So there's no data supporting Joukowsky's paper. If we want to know how much carbon dioxide there is on Mars, which is what you would use to help make an atmosphere for Mars, we're basically going to have to go. We're going to have to drill in a lot of places because the stuff is soaked up into the soil. And if, for instance, it is 1% soaked into the soil down to 200 meters depth, then there's enough CO2 on Mars to create a very ample atmosphere. And Joukowsky has no measurements to support his assertion that it's not there. Now, I can't prove to you that it is there, but if we don't go, we won't know.
Hey, by the way, the fact that NASA basically reprinted his report, all the major media outlets around the country are saying this is a NASA study, and they need to correct that, I bet.
Yeah, huh? That's true. It is not a NASA. NASA reprints many papers that are interesting that people are publishing about space. But this is not a NASA publication. It's a personal publication by a professor.
We'll come back to this, Robert. Let's talk about the ability to get to Mars first and foremost. It looks like if we get there, it's going to be private companies. What do you think?
Well, I think that's true. I mean, we could have been on Mars in the 1980s if the United States government had stuck with NASA's plan that it had at that time, but
yep.
Nixon canceled it. They dropped the ball, and we've been stagnating for 40 years now, almost 50 since Apollo. We haven't gone anywhere, but now private entrepreneurs have picked it up, and, of course, SpaceX is roaring ahead, and they have they've Sputniked NASA. They have just broken the barriers. They have shown they can develop new space systems in one-third the time at one-tenth the cost or less that has become accepted in the aerospace industry in recent years. And they've developed things that everyone said was impossible, like reusable boosters. And now they're building a fully reusable heavy lift booster, a booster with the capability of the Saturn V moon rocket, but instead of being expendable, being reusable. So this thing is going to be flying within 5 or 6 years, and this is going to give us the capability to send humans to Mars.
Do we have today the knowledge and technology to start building the kinds of rockets we need?
Yes, and in fact, SpaceX is doing exactly that.
Wow, dramatic.
This is going on. This is happening.
Let me ask you this. Maybe put it in perspective for us. I mean, we as a country were so far ahead of everybody. I mean, we went to the moon in 1969. That's a 49-year-old technology. We beat everybody. Russians, they still haven't gotten to the moon with a person. China's not there yet. So we were so far ahead. Now that we're doing this primarily with the private market, are we using the same brain power that got us to the moon? Are they working with SpaceX now? How did they evolve so quickly? I guess that's my question.
Okay, well, most of the, almost all of the people that were in the space program in 1969 have retired by now, although a few of them are around. There were certainly a good number of them around when I started my space career. I was not in the space program during Apollo, but when I did become active in the space program, there were still plenty of Apollo veterans around in the 80s. And so the older generation of the people at SpaceX are people who were educated directly by the Apollo generation. They're not the Apollo generation, but they're people who joined the space program while the Apollo people were still around. And then, of course, there's a whole new generation at SpaceX. Actually, if you go to SpaceX, the average age at SpaceX is under 30.
Jeez.
50% of them are under 26.
They're kids.
They're kids, but these are kids that are hot. These are kids, let me tell you, people go to college, and some people go to college so they can get a good job, all right? And, well, everybody likes to have a good job. But the thing is this, if you're going into aerospace, if you don't want to just have a good job, if you want to be part of something that's really making the difference, that's making history, put it that way, you want to go to SpaceX. You know, if you just want to have a good job and not have to work too hard, maybe you go to Boeing or Lockheed Martin. There are good people at those places, there's no doubt. And, I mean, Lockheed Martin has done a lot of successful space missions. But they haven't made breakthrough space technologies. They're not the ones who are trying to reduce the price of going to orbit by a factor of 10 and then another factor of 10, which is what SpaceX intends to do. SpaceX intends to create rocket vehicles that will take us from anywhere on Earth to anywhere else in less than an hour. And once they do that, the market for space launch is going to increase at least 100-fold, if not 1,000-fold, because, you know, there's only about 100 satellites launched to orbit every year, but there's thousands of intercontinental flights every day. And if rockets can move into that market, rockets will be being launched, thousands of rockets every day. And by the way, if you travel that way, you'll get to go through space. You will get to have about a half hour in zero gravity, and if you look out the window, you'll see the blackness of space and the stars blazing away with the full brightness that they have.
Let's talk about the Falcon Heavy, and tell us about this this rocket booster.
Well, the Falcon Heavy is Musk's first crack at a heavy lift vehicle. I would call it a semi-heavy. To give you a perspective, the Space Shuttle or the Atlas or the Titan, Proton, Ariane, these things could all lift about 20 tons to orbit, and so can the Falcon 9 that SpaceX is flying routinely right now, except the Falcon 9 is mostly reusable and these others are completely expendable. Well, Musk has now introduced a vehicle called the Falcon Heavy that can lift 60 tons to orbit. That's three times as much as these other medium lift vehicles. 60 tons, and it's a three-quarter reusable vehicle. Now, with that vehicle, with a couple of launches, you could do a human mission to the moon. With that vehicle, with about three launches, you could do a minimum-size human mission to Mars. It's three times as big as the Atlases and the Deltas and the Protons that are the garden variety launch vehicles. But it's less than the Saturn V. The Saturn V that we had, we went to the moon with, was 140 tons to orbit. So it was still more than double a Falcon Heavy. But Musk is not leaving things with the Falcon Heavy. Even though Falcon Heavy is the strongest launch vehicle right now, he's moving to make it obsolete by building an even stronger vehicle, which is currently called the BFR, and they'll undoubtedly come out with a fancier, more exciting name for it when it, you know, Fire Horse, or who knows what they'll call it. Okay, but anyway, that can do 150 tons. That is, it's in the Saturn V class.
Huge.
It's actually a little bigger than the Saturn V, and it's fully reusable. And to give you a sense, what that could do if it was being used to send people from point to point on Earth would be to send a couple of hundred passengers. It would be to send as many passengers as a Boeing 767.
That's amazing, Robert.
Yeah, and it's being built now. This is not something people are talking about. They're bending metal on this thing.
How big is it? How tall?
It's about as tall as a Saturn V. I think it's roughly 300 feet.
That's like a football field up, right?
Yeah, exactly.
What technology? Now, where are the
if you think about it for a second, we're 50 years after Apollo.
Exactly.
Actually, this sort of thing should have been developed perhaps 20 years after Apollo.
And we could have developed it then, couldn't we?
Yeah. Yes, I mean, we should be, you know, three generations beyond Apollo. Well, this is a generation beyond Apollo, and, well, it's about time, and it's happening.
It's happening big time, too.
Yeah.
How far ahead is Elon Musk from everybody else?
Well, he's pretty far. Now, he's got a competitor, and he's going to have a lot more competitors soon because what Musk has done is proven that it's possible for an entrepreneurial venture to do what previously people thought that only governments of major powers could do. And so there's a lot of other rich people out there who are looking at this and saying, you know, I'd like to try my hand at that. And of course, there's a major organization called Blue Origin, led by Jeff Bezos, who's the owner of Amazon.com and The Washington Post. And they are working on a reusable launch vehicle in the Falcon Heavy class. That is, it will also be able to do about 60 tons to orbit, and it will be mostly reusable. It's called the New Glenn. But there's two different approaches here. Musk is really driven. He wants it done yesterday. B, Bezos' slogan is step by step ferociously. They're taking their time. Bezos has a lot more money than Musk, but Musk has a lot more drive. So we'll see who wins this race. You know, if passion can triumph over money. Musk is taking a lot more chances to move fast.
Hold on for a second, Robert. At the break, we'll be back with more in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Asheville, North Carolina. Talking about having some fun, we're going to be there Saturday, August 25th. Let me tell you about the ticket situation, because they're going very quickly now. There are 3 handicapped seats left in the front. There are 4 tickets left on the lower level. That's it. Then the balcony, where you can take care of yourself. But those are good seats, believe me. It's not like you're way a million miles away from where we're going to be on stage. They're great seats up there. But that's the seating situation for our live stage show, August 25th. Simply go to events at coasttocoastam.com. You can get your tickets that way. Or go straight to the theater at dwtheater.com, D-W-T-H-E-A-T-R-E, dwtheater.com. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Robert Zubin. We'll take calls with Robert next hour. Robert, you know Elon Musk, don't you?
Yes.
You've had some conversations with him about Mars, I think?
Yes, certainly have.
You going to share that with us?
Yeah, sure. I first met Elon in 2001, and Mars Society held a fundraiser in the Bay Area, to help fund our projects, mm-hmm. like Mars Arctic Research Station and the Mars Desert Research Station. And it was $500 a plate, and we got this check from somebody for $5,000. And Elon Musk, who is this? Never heard of him. Looked him up. Oh, he's the head of PayPal. And so I made sure to have like a 2-hour cup of coffee with him before the event, and then came out here to Denver, to my place after the event. We talked some more. And he joined the board of the Mars Society, and he donated $100,000 to help us build our Mars Desert Research Station. And so he was active with us for a while. I mean, he had read the book, The Case for Mars, and it had a real impression on him. But after a while, he said to me, look, you know, I'm not the kind of guy that wants to be part of somebody else's operation. I got to lead my own operation, okay? That's what I do. That's the kind of person.
Yeah.
And so he went off, and he started SpaceX. Well, it wasn't – wait, excuse me. Before I get to that part. And he said to me at that time, because he had cashed out of PayPal, and he had done it just the right time before the dot-com crash. And so he made a lot of money. I have all the money that I could ever want. And so it's not about money for me anymore. I want to do something important. And as far as I can see, the two most important things that I might do at this point is either open up Mars to humanity or make solar energy happen, okay? And I can't decide which one I should dedicate myself to. And I argued forcefully for Mars. I said, look, Elon, you know, solar energy, the business case for it is clear. Anybody who's got an idea of how to make it more efficient can get investment. And if somebody can make it more cost-effective than fossil fuels, it will take over the market. And it doesn't need anyone with the vision that you have to make it happen. It will just happen, okay? On the other hand, the business case for humans to Mars is anything but clear, and it'll take someone with real vision to make that happen. Now, in the end, he decided to do both and then launched the car company too. But it was a remarkable thing. And I have to say, there had been a couple of other very wealthy individuals who thought that they'd be the ones to open the space frontier, and they launched rocket companies. But they didn't do it like him. They just threw some money at it, and when they didn't get easy results, they quit.
They jumped out. Yeah.
Okay. Musk didn't just put his money into it, he put his mind into it. When I first met him in 2001, he had a scientific mind, but he didn't know anything about rockets. And he went and he learned. I mean, he became a real rocket engineer. He learned everything. He became one of the very best rocket engineers I've ever met. And So he put his mind into both the technical side of it and, of course, his business skills and his political skills, because believe me, this is a rough game. The aerospace majors tried to knife him. They tried to prevent them from getting access to any launch sites. You know, there's all sorts of things went on here, and he managed to outmaneuver them. And so, I mean, he really went at it. He put his heart, his soul, his talent into it, and that's why it succeeded. And not only that, okay, I will say something. You know, when I met him a bit later in 2004, SpaceX was already going on, and they were getting ready to launch the Falcon 1. And I told them, look, you have to expect it's going to fail. You have to be ready to launch this at least three times. It's going to fail the first couple of times. And he was so naive at that point that he actually challenged me. He said, tell me why it's going to fail.
Okay. Yeah, it was unacceptable to him, wasn't it?
Well, no. He wanted me to actually point out the system that was going to fail. And I, of course, didn't know enough about the Falcon 1 to know where its flaws were going to be. I was just saying, look, these things are so complicated, you got to expect they're going to fail the first couple of times. And so by 2007, it had failed a couple of times. And I had a conversation with him then, and he said, look, I'm willing to try this one more time, but if it doesn't work, then I'm out. And, well, he tried it one more time, and it failed again, but then he didn't drop out. He tried again, and then they succeeded. And, you know, and that's why they succeed, because he was tough. But he was tough enough to take the hits and keep going. And you take this landing the Falcon. They failed five times before they...
Oh, yeah. I mean, I thought that would never work.
Well, they failed five times. They just kept trying until they made it work. And so, you know, fortune favors the tough. And he's got guts, and he's got tough. So that's why this thing has succeeded. Now, right now, okay, look, you know, Musk, by our standards, you and me, he's a very wealthy guy. According to this one magazine article I read, he's worth $10 billion. Bezos, the head of Amazon.
Worth way more than that.
$100 billion.
Yeah.
Worth 10 times as much as Musk. Right now, Musk is running circles around him. Now, because he's much more driven. On the other hand, when you run around in circles, you can trip. So we're going to see who wins this race here.
Why don't they partner up, Robert?
Well, maybe, but I'm actually glad they're competing, because the fact that they're competing is what's driving Musk. And sooner or later, it's going to start driving Bezos. And now, there's something on here, too, by the way. Okay, first of all, there's going to be a lot more SpaceXs. There'll be a Russian SpaceX. There'll be a Chinese SpaceX. I mean, there may be a Ukrainian SpaceX. I mean, there's lots of countries where there's people who have astronautical engineering skills, and there are people who have got a lot of capital, and if you put the two of those together, you can create a SpaceX.
Yes.
Now, and there's even some people out there who are smart businessmen who can lead this sort of thing. But But he hasn't just done this for space. Right now, there are people starting up fusion power startups. You say, what does that have to do with SpaceX? What it has to do with it is that what Musk has done is he's proven that it's possible for entrepreneurial ventures to do what, or even better, what previously people thought only the governments of major powers could do. And so the fusion power programs of the world have stagnated over the past 20 years, and now there's startups happening. And, you know, I worked in fusion back in the 80s, and I can remember my group leader at Los Alamos telling us at one lunch, he said, you know, look, when fusion power is finally developed, it's not going to be at a place like Los Alamos or Oak Ridge or Livermore. It's going to be a crackpot working in his garage.
Yep, you're right.
Well, maybe not a crackpot in his garage, but a startup in a warehouse, yes. And now you've got fusion startups who are getting investments of $50 million, $100 million, $200 million. One of these is going to develop fusion power. And all sorts of other things are going to happen as a result of this. I mean, he's really breaking down barriers, and in a much broader sense than just the space business. But he's going to start seeing a lot of competition, and this will be good. Because if all he had to compete with were the, you know, mainstream aerospace majors, you know, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, and so forth, he'd only have to price himself 20% below them to take away their business.
That's right.
But that would not really open up the space frontier. We need to have the cost of space launch not drop by 20%, but by a factor of 100.
Is he making any money right now, Robert, or is he losing his shirt?
I think he's making some money on SpaceX. But, I mean, it needs to be emphasized, he's not doing SpaceX to make money. There's a lot of easier ways to make money than launching a rocket.
But he doesn't want to lose his shirt either.
No, he needs, you see, that's the thing. He needs to make money to keep moving this thing forward. The issue is in other words, to keep it advancing, each step has to make money. And this is, once again, a different situation than Blue Origin. Blue Origin is not making money. Bezos just cashes out $1 billion worth of Amazon stock each year and keeps funding the thing. But it's not being driven by this kind of urgency of, we have to get this done quick because this development program is costing us too much. And you see, in aerospace, the faster you develop something, the cheaper it is, because in aerospace, cost is people times time. It is not true that crash programs cost more than slow programs. It's exactly the opposite. And so that's why, that's another reason why SpaceX moves so fast to develop things. They're trying to save money.
Now, you've talked about NASA wanting to build some kind of space station or lunar orbit gateway. What is that?
It's a waste of time and money. In fact, I call it the lunar orbit toll booth. it's really a crazy thing. NASA says that it wants to return to the moon. Well, if you want to return to the moon, you need a lunar lander. You don't need a lunar orbiting space station. And in fact, if you have a lunar orbiting space station and someone makes you go there on your way to the moon, you add propulsion requirements to the mission. You make the mission harder. And not to mention all the money that's being drained away from the lunar program to support this lunar orbiting space station. And this space station is so silly, they're talking about building a whole space station and only having people in it 1 month out of the year. I mean, it's a crazy
thing. That's ludicrous.
It's completely ludicrous. And so it's a toll booth. It's a toll booth both to actual travelers who are trying to go to the moon or to Mars, because they're also saying this is the gateway to Mars. There's no reason to go to a lunar orbiting space station on your way to Mars. It's out of your way. So it's a diversion. So it's a tax on the mission itself, but it's also a tax on the program. The money that they're spending on this lunar orbiting space station is many times what would be needed to create the lunar lander that they need to land on the moon, but they have no program to land on the moon. And in fact, I mean, you know, that's the simplest way of looking at it. That is, if you are doing this as a traditional NASA program, NASA should be spending its money, to, if it wants to land on the moon, to create a vehicle that can land on the moon. Okay? They will never land on the moon if they don't have a vehicle that can land on the moon. Now, another way to do this that would be even faster, frankly, would be to tell the community, SpaceX, Blue Origin, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, hey, we want to send people to the moon. Which of you can offer a service to do it? How much will you charge to deliver 10 tons of payload to the moon, or 30 tons of payload to the moon, or to deliver a crew to the moon and back? What is your rate? And then if someone says, we will do it for this much, and so whoever makes the best offer gets the contract, and then you'll have whoever gets that contract racing like hell to create that capability so they can cash in by selling the transport, you know? I mean, that's how things are done in the commercial world. You buy the ride. You don't have to build the airplane yourself. You buy an airplane ticket. And there are people that are good at building airplanes that will build the airplane, and people good at running airlines that will run the airline.
What do you think of the president's request for a space force?
Well, there's less to that than meets the eye. I mean, a lot of people are getting excited about that, either positive or negative. It's actually not that important. That is, I mean, military space activities are very important. They're decisive. But we already have them. They're mostly in the Air Force. They're somewhat in the Navy. And we have very extensive military space programs. We have reconnaissance satellites, communication satellites, navigation satellites that support the GPS system. All this is very important. I do think that, in other words, the argument for a space force is that so long as Space Command is just part of the Air Force, It's part of a service whose main attention is airplanes. You know, the people who really run the Air Force are fighter pilots or people who used to be fighter pilots. And for them, space is this other thing on the side. You know, people who run the space program, they're not heroes. They don't put their life on the line in single combat against enemy fighters. They're these, you know, desk people, and so they just don't have the status of a fighter pilot in a world controlled by fighter pilots, okay? But so you say if they had their own space force, then they could have a better priority. On the other hand, the Air Force as a service competing for funds with the Navy and the Army has a lot more weight to throw around than an independent space force would. So it's sort of a mixed bag. Frankly, what I would do is not have an independent space force at this time, but just increase the status of the Space Command within the Air Force. Perhaps have the number two officer in the Air Force always be from the Space Force side of it.
What are other countries doing like that, Robert? I mean, they've developed their own space force.
Oh yeah. And in fact, this is a problem because, the U.S. military is much more dependent upon space assets than any other military, much more so than the Russians or the Chinese, for example. We make much more use of reconnaissance satellites, and in particular, we use these GPS-guided munitions, which make a bomb or an artillery shell or a missile, you know, like 100 times more accurate than it would be without it. So these satellites actually, as it were, increase the firepower of our systems by like a factor of 100, because it doesn't matter how many shells you shoot, it's how many that hit that counts. And so what the Russians and the Chinese are doing is they have been developing anti-satellite systems to destroy our satellites. Obviously they're not using them. They would use them in time of war, and they would take out our satellites, and all of a sudden, the accuracy of our armaments goes down by a factor of 100. So we can't have that. Now, the Obama people thought that they would counter this by not developing anti-satellite systems of our own and thereby setting a good example. And that was pretty silly. Now, the Trump people are saying, well, we're not that silly. We'll develop anti-satellite systems too. But that doesn't do it because, frankly, if we lost all of our satellites and the Russians lost all of their satellites, the trade would greatly benefit them. They don't need their satellites as much as we need ours. What we need are fighter satellites that can protect our satellites from anti-satellites. Okay, that's what we need. Okay, in other words, the issue for us is not taking out the other guy's satellites. If we had fighter satellites, they'd be able to do that too.
It's protecting ours.
It's protecting ours, and that's what we need. We need to be able to protect our satellites, and for that we'll need fighter satellites. And in short, therefore, our space forces need a higher priority than they've had. They need to have a clear mission, which is to maintain space supremacy, which means protecting our assets and destroying the other guys.
Robert, when we come back, we're going to take phone calls, but I want you to get specific about Mars and how we can get humans there.